Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael reading from True West Magazine. History of the American Frontier. June 2022 edition. The West's Worst Shootout by Mark Boardman and David Kennedy. The tragedy at Going Snake left 11 men dead and a lot of questions. Ezekiel Proctor was a Cherokee and proud of it. Zeke had walked the Trail of Tears from Georgia to the Indian Territory when he was a 7-year-old boy in 1838. He clung to the Cherokee language, culture, and customs. He dealt with white folks, but he didn't have much use for them. In 1872, the prosperous farmer and local lawman had a beef with one specific white man, his former brother-in-law, Jim Kesterson. Stories circulated of bad blood between them, a situation made worse when Kesterson abandoned Proctor's sister and kids for another woman. Proctor confronted Kesterson at the Hildebrand Mill, just west of Siloam Springs, Arkansas. He pulled a gun and opened up, but Kesterson's new woman, Polly Beck, got in the way and was killed. The shooting would bring Proctor into another confrontation with the U.S. Marshals Service. A shocking statistic. Formed in 1789 to enforce federal law, the U.S. Marshals Service suffered its first casualty 5 years later. Between then and 1872, 11 other officers would die in the line of duty. But the Indian Territory was bad ground for the U.S. Marshals. Officially, between 1872 and Oklahoma statehood in 1907, a shocking 93 officers were killed there. Shocking because, to date, the U.S. Marshals Service has lost a total of 287 officers nationwide, meaning that nearly one-third of those killed lost their lives in the Indian Territory. The statistic is unmatched by any other place or any other period for line-of-duty deaths in American history. The reasons for the disparity in the Indian Territory vary. Too few officers, 200 or fewer, to patrol too large an area, more than 70,000 square miles. Many Indians didn't think highly of the authorities representing the white government, and hard cases of all races found the region fertile ground for illegal enterprises, which fostered an ongoing struggle to control land and power. Serving as a deputy U.S. Marshal in the Indian Territory proved to be a tough and dangerous job, as well as a thankless one. The pay was miserable. Based on fees and expenses, a deputy could expect to make between $400 and $800 a year. The pay often arrived late, sometimes months after it was due. Many of the deputy U.S. Marshals took on second jobs in local law enforcement, with the Indian police, or as railroad detectives. More than a few padded their expense and travel reports to get extra money. Some, including Bob, Gratt, and Emmett Dalton, turned to crime, either on the side or full-time. Why would anybody take on such a job? U.S. Marshals Service historian David Turk says some men didn't want to be farmers or cowboys or merchants. It was a job for the adventurous, he says. But too often, the adventure turned tragic. That's what happened with Proctor and the tragedy at Going Snake. Who decides if Proctor dies? A lot of folks wanted to make Proctor pay after he killed Polly. Her kinfolk wanted Proctor dead, in spite of the fact that he was related to the Becks. The Cherokees wanted to try him since Polly had been a member of the tribe. The U.S., pressured by the Becks, wanted him to pay with his life, since his intended victim, Jim Kesterson, was white. Those kinds of jurisdictional conflicts were common during the Indian Territory era. This particular conflict turned bad. Proctor surrendered to the sheriff and asked for an immediate trial in the Cherokee courts. It was scheduled for April 15, 1872, in a house near present-day Christie, Oklahoma. But on the day of the trial, the proceedings were moved to a schoolhouse located in the Going Snake District, which would give the upcoming incident its name. Polly's kin were upset by the court arrangements. Too many of the locals were related to Proctor, including Cherokee Chief Lewis Downing. The Becks thought the only way to get justice, if they had to settle for that, was to have Proctor tried at the Federal District Court in Fort Smith, Arkansas. The U.S. authorities agreed. Deputy U.S. Marshals Jacob Owens and Joseph Peavy were assigned to retrieve Proctor. But they made a bad decision. Knowing they might face some opposition, the officers put together a heavily armed posse of 15 men, featuring five members of the Beck clan who likely had blood, not arrest, on their minds. The people attending Proctor's trial were also armed. Some say that included the judge, the attorneys, and the defendant. The two groups met when the posse approached the schoolhouse while the court was in session. A remarkable force. The Indian Territory Marshals were remarkable for their time and place. Even before Isaac C. Parker took virtual control of justice in the region as federal judge for the Western District of Arkansas in 1875, people of color wore the badge. Blacks, Indians, mixed races, colors didn't matter that much when hiring the federal lawmen. Historian Art Burton, who has written extensively on black and Indian territorial lawmen, estimates that upwards of 50 men of color served the U.S. Marshals Service in the region during the Old West period. Records aren't clear. Race wasn't noted on enlistment or other employment documents. During his 21 years on the bench, Judge Parker encouraged that hiring practice. Many of the blacks and Indians had grown up in the territory. They knew the geography, the culture, the language, and the people, giving them an on-the-job advantage, especially since the job was primarily in the field. Most of the time, officers delivered legal notices and documents, investigated crimes, rounded up witnesses, and transported them to court, and of course, arrested suspects. They rarely had to deal with train or bank robbers. Anecdotal evidence indicates the marshals frequently focused on the selling or manufacture of liquor, illegal in the territory, timber poaching, white settling on Indian lands, rustling, and counterfeiting. All of which makes the attempted arrest of Proctor a bit out of the ordinary. The result was even more strange. An arrest gone wrong. In many Old West gunfights, history is uncleared on who fired the first shot, and little is known about the incident at the schoolhouse in Going Snake. When the posse rode up, court participants and attendees, about 15 people, heard them and gathered at the door and windows. Another 30 folks, mostly Proctor supporters, gathered outside. It's believed that posseman White Sut Beck tried to push inside the building to take a shot at the defendant. Proctor's brother, Johnson, pushed the barrel down just as the shotgun fired. Then the fight became general. Proctor reportedly fired away with a Spencer carbine. After a few minutes, when the smoke cleared, nine men were dead. Two more died the next day. The posse survivors made a hasty retreat eastward, followed closely by Proctor partisans. Among those killed, eight members of the Marshals Service, including Deputy U.S. Marshal Owens, the largest single loss of life in the agency's history. Three on the other side ended up dead, among them Proctor's brother and his attorney. 11 more people were wounded, including Judge Blackshaw, Six Killer, and Proctor. Word of the disaster spread quickly. The Marshals Service collected another posse to arrest the men who had killed their agents. The Cherokee court, attended by most of those wanted for taking part in the gunfight, reconvened the next day at a nearby house. After a quick hearing and deliberation, the jury acquitted Proctor in the shooting of Polly. Proctor headed to the hinterlands of the Indian Territory, reportedly accompanied by 50 heavily armed Cherokees. Others from the erstwhile court also went into hiding until things had cooled off. Federal authorities asked Chief Downing to turn over Proctor and the others for the Marshall's incident, but he refused, saying that the tribe would handle the matter. The tribe wanted to prosecute the surviving members of the posse, but federal officials were reluctant to hand them over. Finally, about 18 months after the tragedy, the two sides reached an agreement. Charges against Proctor were dropped and exchanged for dropping the charges against the posse. Nobody was tried for crimes committed during the tragedy at Going Snake. Injustice reigns here. Many members of the Marshals Service died in the Indian Territory. For them, justice was hard to come by. During Judge Parker's time on the bench, when 79 men were hanged for the capital offenses of murder or rape, only 5 were executed for killing marshals. A 6th, Crawford Cherokee Bill Goldsby, was convicted of killing a deputy U.S. Marshal during an escape attempt, but he was hanged for another murder. In case after case, killers went free. Either they were never captured or juries acquitted them of their crimes. In other cases, assailants got off with light sentences. Notorious robber Henry Starr killed Deputy U.S. Marshal Floyd Wilson during an attempted arrest in December 1892. Starr finished the lawman off with a point-blank coup de grace shot to the chest. After a number of appeals and reversals, the killer pled guilty to manslaughter and served 5 years in prison. Of course, some of the killers were captured, but never made it to Fort Smith alive. Why the leniency? Many jurors had little love for lawmen. They also disliked outlaws, and that may have played a part. In some cases, the killings occurred in such remote locations with little evidence and no witnesses that the jury could not be convinced to hand down a heavy penalty. For the dead lawman, his loved ones would not receive a pension or insurance money. The government generally didn't pay for a funeral. And all too often, the family received no justice for the loss of a man who died while protecting the community at large. A Cherokee hero. Proctor still had a mark left to make in the Indian Territory. He continued to serve as a local lawman. In 1877, his peers elected him to serve as Cherokee senator from the Going Snake District. To many of his people, he was a hero. What's most surprising, perhaps, was that in 1891, Proctor was hired as a deputy U.S. Marshal, a post he held until around the turn of the 20th century. He died of pneumonia in his own bed in February 1907. He was 76. His body was buried in a family plot not far from where he had accidentally shot and killed Polly, just a few miles away from the site of the tragedy at Going Snake. Mark Boardman is the editor of the Tombstone Epitaph and features editor of True West. David Kennedy is curator of collections and exhibits at the U.S. Marshals Museum. True West, June 2022 edition. The Wildest Town in the Indian Territory, by Art T. Burton. Muskogee, Oklahoma's early years as a frontier outpost were violent, dangerous, and unpredictable. Welcome to Muskogee, the rip-roaring and most dangerous locale west of the Mississippi River. Over the years, I have read about Deadwood, Dodge City, El Paso, Las Vegas, New Mexico Territory, and Tombstone, Arizona Territory. These towns were wild for 4 or 5 years. Muskogee of the Indian Territory was wild for over 40 years. There were over 130 deputy U.S. Marshals killed in the Indian and Oklahoma territories during the frontier era, and most were killed within a 50-mile radius of Muskogee. There were also commissioned United States Indian policemen killed in the line of duty in the same locale. Muskogee and the surrounding counties saw more murders of federal lawmen than anywhere else on the western frontier. Muskogee was originally spelled M-U-S-C-O-G-E-E, but was changed permanently as time went on. The town was situated near the locale known as the Three Forks of the Arkansas, the Dearguss and Grand Rivers near the borders of the Cherokee and Creek Indian nations. The original inhabitants were principally former enslaved blacks of the Cherokee and Creek nations who lived near the river bottoms. The town itself took shape in 1872 with the arrival of the Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railroad, called the Katy by locals, along the rail line. Muskogee was a terminus, or end-of-rail town, as they were called. A Wicked Little Town. In January 1873, Edward King, a writer for Scribner's Magazine, wrote an article on the Frontier Railroad. King interviewed George Reynolds, a Katy special agent in the Indian Territory. During the interview, Reynolds said, "Three men were shot about 20 feet from this same car in one night in Muskogee. Oh, this was little hell, that was. The roughs took possession here in earnest. There was no law here and no means of getting any. As fast as the railroad moved on, the roughs pulled up stakes and moved with it. It was next to impossible for a stranger to walk through one of these canvas towns without getting shot at. The graveyards were sometimes better populated than the towns next to them." Writer King noted with curiosity Muskogee's cemetery, where 11 men were buried with their boots on. "Each grave," he wrote, "is a monument to murder." One of the local outlaws present in Muskogee in 1872 was a mixed-blood Cherokee named Brad Collins. Collins was nearly white in appearance, a smuggler of whiskey, a desperado, and a dead shot. It was said that he could throw a pistol in the air, causing it to make half a dozen turns, catch it as it fell, and strike an apple at 30 paces. It was reported that other shootists in the Indian Territory were in awe of him. In the spring of 1872, the athletic young Collins was under bond to appear at the May term of the federal court in Fort Smith, Arkansas, for shooting at a deputy United States Marshal with intent to kill. Many excused him for a previous incident in which he had killed a deputy U.S. Marshal because it was a private quarrel. Collins's gang included a dozen or more mixed-blooded Cherokees. At that time in the Indian Territory, crimes committed by Indians against Indian citizens were heard in the Cherokee or Creek Indian judicial courts. If a white man committed a crime or was the victim of a crime, the case was heard at the federal court at Fort Smith, which had jurisdiction over western Arkansas and all the Indian Territory. The court's jurisdiction covered 75,000 square miles and was the largest federal court in the U.S. at the time. As a frontier town and railroad terminus town, Muskogee was unique. Other terminuses quickly settled down to become quiet, respectable communities, or faded away altogether. Muskogee alone remained rip-roaring and lawless for 20 years or more. When the Katy Railroad reached the Three Forks in the fall of 1871, the United States agents for the five civilized tribes were headquartered individually with their tribes. The Cherokee agent had his offices in Tahlequah. The Choctaw and Chickasaw agent was located at Boggy Depot. The Creek agent was located near Muskogee. And the Seminole agent was at Weewaka. On July 1st, 1874, the government ordered the consolidation of these agencies, and thereafter, the United States Agency for the Five Civilized Tribes was known as the Union Agency. After 2 years of negotiations, the consolidated agency was finally located at Muskogee, and on or about January 1st, 1876, the agent for the Five Civilized Tribes moved into a brand new Union Agency building. The choice of Muskogee as headquarters for the land-wealthy Indian tribes was probably the decisive factor in Muskogee's survival. The town of Muskogee was in the Muskogee district of the Creek Nation. Most of the Creek light horse policemen of the Muskogee district were African Americans. The blacks were former slaves or descended from former slaves of the Creek Indians, and they were known as Creek freedmen or Indian freedmen. There was bad blood between the Creek freedmen and the Cherokee mixed bloods. In Muskogee, on Christmas Day, 1878, serious trouble broke out when some Black Creek light horsemen disarmed John and Dick Van, two young Cherokees from a prominent family. A lawless Texan passing through town attempted to put the black officers in their place. He led the Cherokees in the gunfight that eventually cost the life of one of the light horsemen and wounded three other black officers. In August 1879, another bloody gunfight took place in Muskogee. John Van was killed, and the Creek light horse captain was wounded. Creek Chief Coachman decided to place a light horse officer on guard in Muskogee proper. He ordered Richard Berryhill, the reliable and efficient captain of the Eufaula District, to undertake the work. But Berryhill protested that the assignment seems to me to be a severe one. If the town of Muskogee was really an Indian town, I would not wait a moment. But as it is, there are but few Indians there. I am more than willing to serve my people, but the way things are, I don't see how I am to risk my life for non-citizens. Muskogee was principally a cow town during its early years. The town was part of the Shawnee Cattle Trail, which went along the route that had been known as the Texas Road. Muskogee also had Katy Railroad cattle pens for shipping, which meant that cattle and cattlemen were big business in the community. Cattle theft was always a problem in the frontier Muskogee area for lawmen, both Indian and federal. In February of 1880, Colonel John Q. Tufts, United States agent for the Union Agency at Muskogee, organized a unit of Indian police to operate throughout the five civilized nations. Agent Tufts' organization of Indian policemen consisted of 30 members, one-third of whom were Cherokees. Their duties were to preserve order, arrest thieves and violators of U.S. law, suppress the whiskey traffic, and execute the orders of the Indian agent. They were stationed at several different points within the jurisdiction of the Union agency and were on duty whenever found. Deadly streets of Muskogee. The first chief of the Union Agency Police and most famous Indian policeman in the history of the Indian Territory was Captain Sam Six Killer. He was assisted by his brother Henry Six Killer on the USIP, as it was known in the territory. Muskogee itself was the foremost responsibility of Captain Six Killer since the Union Agency was headquartered there. Six Killer also had a commission as a deputy U.S. Marshal and a special agent for the Missouri Pacific Railroad, which had recently built a line through the territory. Six Killer's problems centered around bootleggers, cattle thieves, murderers, rapists, timber thieves, white intruders, train robbers, card sharks, and prostitutes following the railroad lines. Six Killer was outstanding in his law enforcement work, but was killed while off duty in Muskogee on Christmas Eve of 1886. Two Cherokee desperados caught the unarmed Six Killer on the streets of Muskogee and filled him with pistol and shotgun fire until he fell dead. Six Killer's successor as captain of the Union Agency Police, William Fields, lasted only 3 months before he was shot to death. In 1888, Bud Kell, a Cherokee who was a well-known and noted deputy U.S. Marshal for the Fort Smith Federal Court and a sergeant in the United States Indian Police at Union Agency, was made Muskogee's first city marshal. Kell was hired by the business community of Muskogee. In 1889, the Fort Smith Court's jurisdictional land area was broken up. Muskogee was selected as the first court in Indian Territory. They only had jurisdiction over minor crimes. Major crimes were referred to Fort Smith. Most of the law enforcement for the Muskogee area was done by deputy U.S. marshals assigned to the Fort Smith Federal Court. In July of 1893, a deputy U.S. marshal named Sherman Russell from the Fort Smith Court was killed at Muskogee while trying to deliver an arrest warrant. The fugitive was never apprehended. By 1897, the federal court at Muskogee had full coverage for the Northern Federal District for Indian Territory. The U.S. Marshal for the court was Leo E. Bennett. One of the deputies assigned to the court that year was the legendary black Fort Smith deputy U.S. Marshal Bass Reeves, who earlier had worked for the federal court at Paris, Texas. The town of Muskogee was incorporated in March of 1898 and at the same time, its first municipal police department was formed. In 1902, the two deputy U.S. Marshals assigned to Muskogee were Bass Reeves and a white man named David Adams. For the most part, Adams served as Reeves' posse. Although Muskogee had a municipal police department because it was part of the Indian Territory, most of the work fell on the U.S. Marshal's Office for criminal activity in and around Muskogee. In May 1902, Reeves and Adams went to the nearby town of Braggs in the Cherokee Nation and arrested 24 men for being involved in a race war. They arrested 15 white men and 9 black men without any resistance and brought the prisoners to the federal jail in Muskogee. The biggest gunfight in Muskogee took place the same year as statehood in 1907. A group of black anarchists called the United Socialist Group, led by preacher William Wright, took over a large two-story house in Muskogee and said they didn't have to pay rent. On March 26, 1907, two city policemen, John Coalfield and Guy Fisher, were dispatched to serve eviction warrants. The policemen were attacked. Fisher was wounded in the shoulder and Coalfield was shot in the chest. Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Bud Ledbetter, along with a large group of lawmen, both city and federal, arrived at the house. During the intense gunfight, Ledbetter was identified as killing two of the anarchists, and Bass Reeves killed one and wounded another. Paul Smith, a black city officer, killed one of the desperados, and in doing so, saved Bud Ledbetter's life during the gunfight. Another black city officer involved was R.C. Cotton. Of the socialist group in the gunfight, 5 were killed and 7 were arrested. As a frontier town, Muskogee was well integrated with no segregated housing between blacks, whites, and Indians. Everyone shopped downtown at stores and businesses owned by various ethnic groups. There were 2 black business districts in Muskogee that were popular with all the residents of the town. Muskogee became the federal headquarters for the Dawes Commission, which broke up Indian lands held in common and parceled out allotments to Indians and Indian freedmen before Oklahoma statehood in November of 1907. Muskogee was a wild frontier town for many years with legendary lawmen like Bass Reeves, Bud Ledbetter, Bud Kell, and Sam Sixkiller to keep the peace. We have heard about Tombstone, Deadwood, Dodge City, and El Paso, but we have to add Muskogee of the Indian Territory to the list of frontier towns of note. Muskogee was the cow town, end of rail town, Wild West town that was too tough to die. Art T. Burton, a retired college history professor, is the biographer of landman Bass Reeves and outlaw Cherokee Bill. Burton's research has shed light on frontier individuals who have received little press. He has appeared in many television documentaries on the Western frontier and the Old West. True West, June 2022 edition. The Grand Old Park by Candy Moulton. Yellowstone, America's first national park, celebrates its 150th anniversary. Ferdinand V. Hayden, head of the U.S. Geological and Geographic Survey of the Territories, led a scientific expedition to the northwest corner of Wyoming Territory in 1871. The artist and photographer who accompanied him carried the tools of their trades and documented the trip with a series of photographic images and sketches, later to become incredible watercolor paintings. Artist Thomas Moran sketched and later painted the ethereal beauty of the area. Massive waterfalls, stunning multicolored canyon walls, geyser basins. At the same time, photographer William Henry Jackson captured images that also became iconic. And Moran kept a journal of their travels. The men in this scientific expedition successfully relayed their journey to a wider audience when they completed the expedition. They developed not only art and photographs, but an improved map of the region. Hayden himself said that when considered in terms of scientific value, the geysers of Iceland sink into insignificance in comparison with the hot springs of the Yellowstone and Firehole basins. Their work set a tone for scientific research and exploration, and most importantly, it established Yellowstone region as one of national significance, leading to the establishment of the ecosystem as the nation's first national park on March 1, 1872. It was recognized by President Ulysses S. Grant, who signed the Yellowstone National Park Protection Act for the benefit and enjoyment of present and future generations. Travelers to Yellowstone for the past century and a half have followed the footsteps of Hayden, Jackson, and Morin, and also documented the wonders of Yellowstone on sketch pads, with cameras, now with cell phones, and certainly in their writings. Morin wrote, "The mountains southeast of our camp and on the road to the lake, looking toward the Yellowstone country, glorious, and I do not expect to see any finer general view of the Rocky Mountains." The Magic of Yellowstone. I first drove the figure eight road system of Yellowstone as a child with my family in the 1960s. I remember a few key things from the trip. The massive structure of Old Faithful, where our family, an aunt and uncle, and some cousins sat on the grass and ate bologna sandwiches. Old Faithful spouting high into the air, hissing and seeming to smoke as the steam rose. The yellow, red, orange colors of the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone, and the sound of crashing water, and feeding the bears, which was a common practice in those days. We saw lots of black bears as they sat begging beside the road. We gave them the last piece of one of the bologna sandwiches, and about 30 minutes later, my cousin Curtis was rolling on the back seat floor of our car, whining that he was going to starve because we gave that last sandwich to a bear. He didn't, and years later, the practice of feeding the bears ended, to the bear's good health and fortune. My next memorable trip to Yellowstone took place in 1990, when I had a chance to horse pack into the backcountry. We left from Buffalo Bill's old hangout at Pahaska Teepee, at the east entrance to Yellowstone, rode north, camped for a week exploring along the Lamar River before riding over Mist Creek Pass through Pelican Valley and back to a trailhead. Most people who visit Yellowstone spend time in the major visitor areas, Canyon, Old Faithful, Mammoth, and Lake Yellowstone, and at the significant geyser basins, most significantly the active Norris Geyser Basin. Just a very small percentage get into the true backcountry. So as a result, much of that country is much the same as it was 150 years ago when the region first received national park status. The people of Yellowstone. The human history of the area dates back thousands of years, and during the past couple of centuries, dozens of tribes have spent time in Yellowstone. One of the most documented events is the 1877 flight of Nez Perce, who spent weeks traversing the park, taking captive some Montana tourists, whom they eventually released. They traveled through Pelican Valley, over Mist Creek Pass, and along the Lamar River as they outpaced the U.S. Army led by General Oliver O. Howard, who pursued them from western Idaho across Montana, Yellowstone, and back into Montana, where they were eventually surrounded by different troops, and most were forced to surrender. Nez Perce Creek is named for these travelers, and you'll find an interpretive area midway between Old Faithful and Madison Junction, where the creek crosses the park. I spent my backcountry trip in Yellowstone reading the Great Mountain Man book, Give Your Heart to the Hawks, by Wynn Blevins. But an equally great place to sit and read is on the outdoor veranda or second floor seating areas in the great lobby of Old Faithful Inn. The massive structure is an iconic national park lodge that was seriously threatened by wildfires in the park in 1988 and saved in part due to installation of irrigation sprinklers. learn more of the history of the park, and see art and artifacts related to the Hayden Expedition at the Park Visitor Center in Mammoth, where you can stay in the Mammoth Hotel, hang your hat in a small cabin, or even find a campsite nearby. Family time in Yellowstone. The summer of 2021, my most recent trip to Yellowstone, was a journey with granddaughters. The COVID-19 pandemic was still posing challenges to travelers, but it was one of the best vacations. We visited Old Faithful and the Overlook to see the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone and the falls. We avoided the massive crowds in Norris Geyser Basin. Cars were lined up for more than a mile outside the official parking areas, and instead walked the trail at Fountain Paint Pots and ended up in a buffalo traffic jam in the Hayden Valley. We had a picnic off one of the one-way roads between Norris and Canyon, where we shared a table with other travelers, saw families sitting on blankets they had thrown on the ground, and watched an older couple play cards in the dappled sunlight of the pine forest. That is the kind of experience to have in Yellowstone. To celebrate the sesquicentennial of Yellowstone National Park, the indigenous tribes who have connection to this land are developing programs and exhibits. The Wind River Intertribal Gathering, June 1st through 3rd, will be an opportunity for tribal nations and others to discuss conservation and the history of the tribes in the region while celebrating the importance of the area to American Indians. This event is being organized by the Shoshone and Arapaho tribes, but all Native nations and others are invited to take part. The Conversations on Collecting Yellowstone Conference takes place in Bozeman on June 5th through 8th and includes speakers on a range of topics from the historic lodges of the park to details about the 1871 Hayden Expedition. A wide spot in the road. The least visited area of Yellowstone is the Tower Roosevelt area, which is midway between Mammoth and Tower on the park's figure-eight road system. Roosevelt has cabin accommodations and a main dining room, and offers horseback and wagon rides that often include meals served under the vast expanse of sky. In this region, see the basalt columns that reflect the volcanic eruptions that formed Yellowstone. View petrified wood, or hike on trails that are not over-traveled. Truly, Roosevelt is a place to enjoy some of the solitude of Yellowstone. Good Eats and Sleeps. Old Faithful Inn and Snow Lodge are both suitable for families, and there are faster food options at Old Faithful Village as well. At Mammoth, a more upscale meal is available at the Mammoth Hotel, but the Mammoth Terrace Grill will get you in and out quickly. A quick meal is also the ticket at Canyon Lodge Eatery and Grant Village Dining Room. Without a doubt, the most serene dining experience in Yellowstone is at the Lake Yellowstone Hotel, which caters to an older clientele with fewer children. All of those facilities also have a variety of lodging cabins, options from a cabin or hotel room to more luxurious accommodations, including the suite at Lake Yellowstone that has often been used by U.S. presidents when they visit the park. Bridge Bay Campground is the park's largest, but there are other smaller campgrounds throughout the park. Permits are required for backcountry camping. True West, June 2022 edition. Red Lodge, Montana, by Peter Corbett. Discover the Old West in the gateway town to America's most beautiful highway. Heading southwest across the high plains of south central Montana brings travelers to a dramatic rising curtain of mountains in the Absaroka Range with eight summits over 12,000 feet. This is the backdrop for Red Lodge, Montana, elevation 5,553 feet, a town that got its start mining coal in 1884. Tourists have replaced miners with travelers drawn to these mountains and the astonishing Beartooth Highway that runs 65 miles from Red Lodge to Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming. "We're the first mountains you hit," said Sherry Weimer, Red Lodge Chamber Director. It's flat, flat, flat. And then, bam, there's Red Lodge Mountain and the Absorcas. Red Lodge is the eastern terminus of the Beartooth Highway, which Charles Kuralt called the most beautiful drive in America. But by no means should travelers leave Red Lodge without sampling the town's many attributes. There's unusual fare, including pig racing at the nearby Bear Creek Saloon and Steakhouse, plus the Beartooth Rally and the Iron Horse Rodeo for motorcyclists. More traditional attractions include the Yellowstone Wildlife Sanctuary. The elegant Pollard Hotel, dating back to 1893, has hosted Copper Barons, Buffalo Bill Cody, and Calamity Jane. The Carbon County Arts Guild and Depot Gallery is more than a whistle stop for art lovers at the restored 1889 Burlington Northern Station. Red Lodge's former Miners Hall from 1909 is home to the Carbon County Historical Society and Museum. Coal mining built Red Lodge into a boomtown in the 1890s, but mining tailed off 30 years later. Tragedy struck in 1943 when an explosion in the Smith Mine trapped and killed 74 miners, some of whom wrote death notes to loved ones before they perished. Other footnotes of Red Lodge history include reports that Harry Longabaugh, the Sundance Kid, and the Wild Bunch Gang planned to rob the Red Lodge Bank in 1897, but called it off after marshals got wind of their plot. More recently, Ernest Hemingway was said to frequent Red Lodge in the 1930s when he spent 5 summers riding at a cabin near Yellowstone and fly fishing on the Clark's Fork River. Of course, fishing, hiking, mountain biking, camping, and snow skiing are popular pursuits in Red Lodge, which is surrounded by over 1 million acres for outdoor exploring, Weimer said. The Beartooth Highway, U.S. 212, is a gateway to those pursuits when it's open for travel from Memorial Day to mid-October. Montana travel writer Becky Lomax described the road out of Red Lodge as it climbs through a narrow valley and up switchbacks to the Rock Creek Overlook at 9,000 feet. The views are absolutely spectacular. The alpine tundra of 10,940-foot Beartooth Pass is stark with few trees and the air is thin, but the landscape is sprinkled with bright colors when wildflowers bloom in late July into early August. It's worth stopping at several alpine lakes, the top of the World's Store, and the Clay Butte Fire Tower with views of the Pilot and Index Peaks, said Lomax, whose latest book is U.S. and Canadian Rocky Mountain Road Trips. She prefers the views traveling east to west on the Beartooth Highway from Red Lodge to Yellowstone rather than the opposite direction. There's also a side trip to Cody, Wyoming on the Chief Joseph Highway to visit the Buffalo Bills Center of the West. Back in the Red Lodge, after a day trip, travelers can browse shops, restaurants, and bars in the town's historic buildings. Bar hopping in Red Lodge is kind of a big deal, Lomax noted. They have some of those really fun, old, funky bars. A local brewery, Red Lodge Ales, is on the north side of town. Red Lodge's summer tourist season is highlighted by the Rodeo of Champions and parades July 2nd through the 4th. In the winter, visitors hit the slopes at Red Lodge Mountain and compete in ski-during races, a Scandinavian tradition in which equestrians pull skiers. And did I mention pig racing that you can bet on? Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier. Alaska's Wild West, June 2022 edition, by Mike Kopuk. Adventure and history await discovery across the last frontier state. Several years ago, I was a long-term substitute teacher in the Yupik Alaskan village of Akiak when the generator broke down. It was February, and the village had no heat and no lights. I crawled into my sleeping bag wearing my coat, a little worried about hyperthermia. The forecast called for a low of minus 30. I was drifting in and out when I heard barking. Wolves were coming in for the dogs. Lights usually kept the wolf pack from entering the village, but the easy meal the dogs made was too hard for the wolves to resist now that the village was pitch black. Suddenly, a shotgun blasted, followed by another. Yupiks were not about to lose part of their dog teams to wolves. I got up around 6 a.m., trudging through snow to the school to get ready for my class. The air was crisp to the point of being painful. Moonlight was illuminating my breath. I heard a chopping sound. I could make out an elderly woman to my left, wearing everything she could find to stay warm as she chopped firewood for heat and cooking. My replacement flew in that afternoon, and I showed him around the village. He thought he saw a caribou skin stretched out across the side of a cabin. It looked odd to me until we got closer. It was a wolf pelt. There was a native woman in the doorway braving the cold for a smoke. She said a hunter had brought it in from the tundra a few days earlier. Another woman had taken it into her cabin, thawed and skinned it, and then tacked it up to dry. When we walked away, my replacement asked if I ever planned to come back to Alaska. "I always come back," I said. "It is as close as I can ever get to how the Old West really was." The Yukon beckons adventurers. People come to Alaska to experience a past that built their national character, constructed the American DNA. Poet Robert Service described those who went to Alaska as a race of men who don't fit in. A friend living in Denali said Alaskans are the wanted and the unwanted. They were men and women who only felt comfortable living on the edge of society, moving farther and farther out until they fell off the map. Robert Service was one of those wanderers. In 1904, he was northbound for Yukon Territory when he got off at Juneau for a few days. He wandered into a watering hole called the Missouri, today's downtown Imperial Saloon, lingering long enough to witness a gunfight. It became the basis for his poem, The Shooting of Dan McGrew. In 1897, Wyatt Earp got out of Wrangell, Alaska, after being marshal for only 10 days during the Klondike Gold Rush. The Soapy Smith gang had chased out the previous lawman, and while passing through en route to the Klondike, Earp agreed to take the job until the new marshal arrived. Once the lawman stepped off the boat, Wyatt and Josie were out of there, bound for Dawson City. The Earps would winter in Rampart, as the Yukon River was frozen over. They would make it to Nome in 1898. By the docks and down the street from Juneau's Imperial Saloon, the Red Dog Saloon has the legendary Wyatt Earp pistol mounted to the wall. While the Smith & Wesson No. 3 has attracted notoriety for a century, Earp and Josie were 1,000 miles away in Nome. Nearby, the Alaskan Hotel was open during the gold rush. The owners tied the front keys to a balloon, releasing it into the air, declaring the Alaskan would never close. It never did, but locals believe it is haunted by those who failed to earn passage home. Over the bridge to the town of Douglas, one can walk the ruins of the Treadwell Mines, once the richest gold mine in the world. Take the state ferry to LeConte to the town of Tenakee Springs. The actual hot springs is next to the wharf. Gold rush miners wintered here for years with their winter wives, prostitutes who cohabitated with miners in the winter, keeping house for a cut of the gold. Or take the ferry north to Glacier Bay. Besides lodges, there are campgrounds within the park. Here, John Muir did studies in 1879 on glaciers while crying out for the preservation of Alaska. Army Lieutenant Charles Erskine Scott Wood discovered Glacier Bay in 1877 after being chased here by a rare Great Glacier Bear. He had been guiding the Charles Taylor expedition to the 18,008-foot Mount St. Elias, then believed to be the highest peak on the continent. Taylor finally gave up, returning to Sitka. His Tlingit porters scattered when they saw the Glacier Bear, no relation to Canada's creamy white Kermode ghost bear. Wood played medicine man for the Hoonah Tlingits before returning to Sitka with the chief's daughter. 2 years later, he was in Montana, standing next to General O.O. Howard, recording Chief Joseph's immortal words, "From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever." National Park Service employees spot the rare glacier bears now and then around the famed bay. There is also one mounted in the lobby of the Sitka Airport. Continuing north, Haines is the home to the 4,000-acre Fort William Seward, the last of 11 forts built in Alaska during the Gold Rush. Fort William Seward, with its 85 wood-frame structures, also served as a deterrent during the border dispute with Canada that was not resolved until 1903. Haines is also the starting point for the Dalton Trail. The trail served as a freighting route to the Klondike in 1899. Constructed by Jack Dalton, along with a series of trading posts, it was a toll road enforced by Dalton's six-shooters. Jewel of Frontier Alaska. The gem of Western lore, though, is Skagway. A young Jack London landed in Skagway in 1897. He found Skagway to be made up of muddy streets, lined with tents and shacks. Gunfire filled the air. Prostitutes conducted business in public view. Northwest Mounted Police Superintendent Samuel Steele called Skagway little better than a hell on earth. London and others found refuge inside the Red Onion Saloon, still in operation today. It had been a brothel as well back then. A patron would choose one of 10 dolls behind the bar. When he went upstairs with one of the girls, the bartender would lay the doll down to show that the girl it represented was occupied. An epic land like Alaska needed an epic outlaw. Skagway's Jefferson Soapy Smith filled the bill. A con man from Colorado, Smith was, with his gunmen, controlled a number of Skagway's saloons as well as in Wrangell. They robbed would-be millionaires along the Dead Horse Trail leading to the Klondike. Smith made the con game an art form. He opened a visitor's bureau, handing out free maps with campsites marked. His men then waited at the marked campsites to rob them. His best scam was the Dominion Telegraph, which amounted to an office with a copper wire running from it to a tree a mile out of town. For $5, people arriving could send word home that they had made it. There was always a reply, a fake message telling the sender things were bad at home, back at home, asking for money to be wired immediately to help out, which they usually did, from the fake telegraph office. Smith's stealing and killing caused returning prospectors to avoid Skagway, reducing business for others in town. A citizens' meeting was held, and engineer Frank Reed and Jesse Murphy agreed to do the deed. On July 8, 1898, at 9:15 p.m., Smith, Murphy, and Reed shot it out on the Juno Wharf. Reed wounded the con man Smith, and Murphy finished Smith off with a shot in the heart. Before he was killed, Smith got Reed in the groin. Soapy died instantly from Murphy's fatal shot, while Reed died days later in intense pain. Both are buried in the Skagway Cemetery, along with prospectors and ladies of the evening. Others who walk Skagway's wooden boardwalks include Madams Honora Ornstein, known as Diamond Lil Davenport, and Maddie Silks. Sid Grauman, who later opened his Chinese theater in Los Angeles with Klondike Gold. Wilson Misner, who opened L.A.'s Brown Derby. Augustus Mack, who founded Mack Trucks. And Wild West showman gunman Charlie Meadows. Captain Jack Crawford, the poet scout of the West, who rode with Colonel William F. Buffalo Bill Cody and James Butler Wild Bill Hickok, went through Skagway to the Klondike Gold Rush, sporting a white goatee, long hair, and a buckskin shirt, and ended up selling everything from ice cream to hay out of his store in Dawson called the Wigwam. The Klondike reminded him so much of the Old West, he wrote his old friend Buffalo Bill about coming north to participate in all the fun. Nearly all of Skagway's Gold Rush buildings are still standing, including the Red Onion and Soapy's Saloon, along with the impressive Arctic Brotherhood Hall, constructed from 8,800 pieces of driftwood, all part of the Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park. The Earps made it to Juneau, but turned around and returned to San Francisco after Josie had a miscarriage. But Wyatt decided to make another go for Alaska, this time on the derelict freighter SS Brixham. Sadie boasted that Wyatt helped put down a mutiny before changing ships at Dutch Harbor. At St. Michael, they took a riverboat bound for the Klondike, but became diced in until sourdough legend Al Mayo rescued them and had them stay over the winter. At Mayo's, they met Tex Rickard, future Madison Square Gardens owner, noted bootlegger Charlie Hoxie, and soon-to-be novelist Rex Beach. Spring found the Earps back at St. Michael with Wyatt managing a canteen, selling cigars and beer, until Hoxie's and Rickard's letters enticed them to the Nome Gold Rush. The St. Michael cabin the Earps lived in is still in use as a residence today. In Nome, Wyatt partnered with Hoxie to open the only two-story Dexter Saloon in Alaska. Earp and Rickard staged boxing matches when the long winter hit, along with drinking contests and food drives. Earp was on the watch committee, keeping an eye out for claim jumpers, and was arrested once for interfering with a local law officer. Legend has it, the Earps left Nome and Alaska in 1900 with $85,000 when Earp sold out his piece of the Dexter. It was Wyatt's most successful venture ever. Stepping back in time. Echoes of the Old West can be found along the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks, where low-roof log cabins dating back to its gold rush line the banks. Cordova, though, holds a real gem from the Old West. Besides the massive rosewood bar inside the Alaskan, there's the Red Dragon. On a hill overlooking downtown in ornate Edwardian style, the landmark was built as a place where alcoholics and drug addicts could dry out. Local historians claim mountain man Yellowstone Kelly was once a tenant. He had come north with the Harriman expedition in 1899. Today, the Red Dragon serves much the same purpose. You'd be advised to knock first before entering. A chain of roadhouses where a traveler could get warm, have a meal and a night's sleep, while his dogs and horses were tended to, used to dot Alaska's Arctic trails. Some are still standing. Rika's Roadhouse at Delta Junction is now a museum and restaurant. Admission is free. Built in 1904 and operated by Rika Wallen until her death in 1969, it is a prime example of what an Alaskan roadhouse was all about. Other historical roadhouses still in operation are Copper Center Inn in Copper Center, Gaycona Roadhouse in Gaycona, Talkeetna Roadhouse in Talkeetna, Sheep Mountain Roadhouse in Sutton, and Eureka Roadhouse in Glen Allen, known for its pies and 25-cent cup of coffee. 1,000 miles to the west on the raw, windswept Unalaska Island, prospectors going to Nome by ship attended dances held in the three-story North American Commercial Building. In 1890, these dances were hosted by one of the few women living in Yuna, Alaska, Molly Stanley Brown, the daughter of assassinated President James A. Garfield. Mike Coppock was born and raised in western Oklahoma, and after graduating from Phillips University in Enid, he has lived off and on in Alaska since 1985. In Alaska, he has taught history in an Alaska bush community, worked as an editor of two Alaskan newspapers, and was a flight specialist for the FAA. He is currently a historical interpreter at Denali National Park.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.